So the opening evening, I kind of set the theme and introduced the idea of Dharma delight and Dharma joy and Dharma tranquility and Dharma happiness and Dharma concentration. Later, someone told me that Dharma delight sounded like an ice cream flavor. And so the question is, what is it that the word Dharma adds to these words, these concepts, that's not there without it? And I think, you know, the Dharma adds something. I don't know if it adds something or subtracts something. It might be more with the word Dharma, maybe there's actually something not there. Maybe the adds and subtracts both. So what is this, the wonderful word Dharma, and how does it relate to all this? When I was first introduced to Vipassana practice, it was in Thailand at a monastery. And in that monastery, there were a few people, monastics, who were clearly, I could feel that they were deep practitioners. And some of them had been practicing for a long time, and they were certain maturity or freedom and that was palpable, that inspired me. So I went up to one of these monastics and asked, in your years of being in the monastic life, what have you learned? What's changed for you? And I got a one-word reply: non-contentiousness. And I was like, really? That's it? But then John yesterday talked about non-struggle. And then I don't actually know the Thai word. It was a translator who translated it into non-contentiousness. So, and but non-struggle. I like the idea of non-conflict. The Buddha once said, there are people who are in conflict with me, but I am not in conflict with anyone. In ordinary English, I think, if we say someone's in conflict with me, it's kind of like saying, I have a conflict, you know, because it kind of goes together, right? But what is that like if someone's in conflict with me, but I'm not in conflict with them? How can that be? Is that possible? There's a story of a man who was angry with the Buddha. And he came to give the Buddha the peace of his mind. And so he did. And the Buddha, I guess, just listened. And then the Buddha, when it was time for the Buddha to speak, he said, you know, if you go to someone's house, maybe for a supper, for a meal, and you give them a gift. I don't have the story exactly right, but those of you who know Pali, it's does, but something like this. So you know, if you give them a gift, and they decline it, who does the gift belong to? Well, then, if they decline it, then it's still mine. In the same way, I decline your anger. So where does it stay? And then who's suffering then? But this, you know, non-struggle, non-contention, non-conflict, is it appropriate? Is it reasonable? How is that done? How does that work? When is it appropriate? What allows a person to have someone angry at them or have someone in conflict with them, but they don't reciprocate, they don't feel the conflict, they're not in conflict, but they're in relationship. They're willing to talk and be present and find a way, but they don't feel a conflict. What's it like to have non-conflict with oneself? What's it like to not struggle with oneself? And some of you know that one of the inspiring teachings that I received secondhand from Suzuki Roshi, a Zen teacher, was the very simple little phrase, don't be bothered by your thoughts. And now that really struck something inside of me when I heard that. Don't be bothered by your thoughts. And part of the reason it struck something was that I was being bothered by them. I thought they were wrong, I shouldn't have them, I should get rid of them, I should, you know, stop them, be quiet, have a silent mind, all kinds of things. I shouldn't have those thoughts. So I should have other thoughts. And so not be bothered by them, that was like a new idea. And in fact, I learned over time to not struggle with my thoughts, not be in contention with them. And when I was no longer bothered by them, then it turns out I wasn't fueling them. I wasn't perpetuating them. And there's a wonderful kind of ecology of thinking. If we're bothered by them, we actually encourage them. I saw that with my children. That sometimes I was maybe cooking dinner, and it was not really the time to play with them. And, but they wanted attention, wanted someone to play with. And if I said no, this is not the time, they had all these ways of continuing to want to get attention, want to be engaged. And even if I kind of said it more strongly or bordering on anger, you know, this is not the time, they had what they wanted. They had the attention. That's all they wanted. So, you know, it didn't really matter that it was saying no. Just say it again because I had, you know, we're in relationship they wanted to have. So, you know, hopefully in those situations when it was not so, in my assessment, not so in dire crisis, I would just, I learned that I had to ignore them and just make dinner. Because anything but ignoring them gave them what they wanted and they wanted more. So, anyway, I don't know what you think of that story, but or my parenting. but anyway, sometimes that's the way it is with the mind. Sometimes, you know, the mind needs a very firm no, not now. And sometimes the limits need to be set, like for a little kid, and children need the limit setting. That was another thing that surprised me as a young parent, new parent, was I kind of, probably to a fault, grew up in a culture where you try to, you know, accommodate everyone and find a way and let's have counsel and talk about it and let's reach consensus here. and you know, a two-year-old, it didn't quite work, right? And so sometimes this two-year-old, they kept pushing. I think apparently what they sometimes wanted, they wanted to know where the limit was of what was acceptable. And then they'd feel safe. But until they weren't going to push until they found out where it was. So at some point, I would finally say, no, you can't do that in a clear way. And my son would look at me as if I was the world's awfulest person for about a second. And then he was really happy and he would settle down. Like, oh. And the psychological theory was that now he knew the limit and he could feel safe. But without that, he needed, it was just the world was too confusing. And he was kind of, for him, he has the dyslexia. And so the world is a little bit kind of, you know, maybe difficult place to negotiate sometimes. And so to know where the boundaries were. Very helpful for him. So sometimes our mind also needs to know. No. But sometimes the mind needs to just, the thinking mind is best just to leave it alone. Don't be bothered by it. let it be in the background. And one of the things I learned is to not live in my thoughts, not to center myself in my thinking. So I'm not in conflict with the thoughts, not struggling with them, but it's also not where sometimes where I live. And so thinking kind of, my image is, it's kind of recedes to the periphery. It's there in the background. It's there if I need it. But it's not where I sit. It's not where I, you know, especially when I meditate or do something like this, it, you know, I'm not, you know, I just let it go to the, you know, not, I don't be bothered by it. And sometimes I know I'm thinking, but I don't even know what I'm thinking sometimes because it's so far and so faint in the background. So not be bothered by the thoughts. But, you know, we're bothered by all kinds of things. We're in struggle with ourselves and in conflict with this and that. And so the Dharma teaches us something about conflict, how it works, but also teaches us a possibility of being without conflict. Is that possible? What does that look like? Without struggle. And how do we live a responsible life? How do we live a life where we take care of ourselves and respond to the situations of the world in ways where we're not in conflict or we don't struggle, but we might act very strongly. We might do powerful things. Was Mahatma Gandhi in conflict with Great Britain when he marched to the sea to get salt? There was a whole empire that, one of the most powerful empires of the time, that was in conflict with him going to get salt. But was he in conflict? I don't know. It seems to me maybe he wasn't. But he kind of counted on England being in conflict with him. That was a strategy. And so, but you know, he just marched to the salt and picked some salt out of the salt flats and got arrested. And the rest is history. And what can we learn about non-conflict, non-struggle in sitting and meditating and being on retreat? What is it that it teaches us? So one of the places that teaches us is, as a teacher for us in this regard, is learning to relax. And so the Dharma tranquility is a third of these five qualities that are closely connected: delight, joy, tranquility, happiness, and joy. And tranquility can mean calm, relaxation, serenity, perhaps. And but the way that the texts talk about it, the Buddha talked about it, was a tranquil body. The body becomes tranquil. And so to begin learning a degree of tranquility in the body, I spent the years with tense stomach. And one of the things that I worked on in meditation for years was learning to keep the stomach relaxed. And, I didn't make it like a big project, but it was there in the background. I would sit down to meditate and I'd soften my belly. And then it would tighten up. And then I'd just let it stay tight. And then, because I wasn't going to make a big project out of it, that's not quite meditation. But then, you know, later I would relax it again. And slowly over time, as I sat and meditated, this chronic tension that I kept in my stomach started to relax. Tensions that I had in my chest, in my heart, in my face, different places. First I discovered I had it, and there's all kinds of tensions I didn't even know I had until I started meditating. You know, on the surface I was a much more relaxed person before I meditated. But on the surface, that's what it looked like or felt like. But once, you know, once I started getting into it, I started seeing actually I was carrying a lot of tension. And so as my body relaxed, that became a teacher for me, because then I could notice when I tensed up again. When I was chronically tense, I didn't even know I was tense. When I was chronically tense, there was no reference point. It was like, this is the status quo. But there was a heightened sensitivity as I relaxed my body, and a heightened reference point and a greater contrast between being relaxed and tightening up again. And I've found it an invaluable teacher to kind of the tension in the body, and relaxation and the tightening up and all the different ways that it happens. And rather than letting yourself be unconscious about it or ignore it or take it for granted, it's supposed to be this way, and reality was built in such a way that humans are supposed to be tense, it's possible to question the tension. If you're relaxed, if you're really deeply relaxed, and then you feel the tension come up, then that means that the tension is not chronic and it's not locked in. And so it's a really great time to start questioning, what just happened here? Is this necessary to get tense? What am I tense about? What's the attachment? What's the preoccupation? What's the concern? And there's a lot to learn there. And there are certainly tensions which are appropriate to have. We're not supposed to just be jello all the time, walking around Buddhist jello. But there are tensions that are appropriate in certain circumstances. But there's a lot of unnecessary tension. And the unnecessary tension can be our teacher, in the sense that we can understand and see in what we believe, what we're attached to, what we're resisting, what our expectations are, what we're trying to protect. All kinds of things can be kind of shown, and then we can begin looking at that and trying to understand better what that is. And then a few things, many things can be learned, but one of them is it's possible to start having some kind of tranquility when things are difficult. And that has a whole range of things. There can be being kind of tranquil or calm about being tense. Don't struggle or don't be contentious with your tension. Don't feel like, oh no, here I am at the biggest Vipassana retreat in Santa Cruz County. And wow, this is like a serious place, and I better not be tense. because you're supposed to be Buddhist, supposed to be jello. And so then we're upset and bothered. But to be tranquil, to be relaxed, to be non-contentious with the tension we have. And that's, I propose, is a phenomenal thing, that distinction. Because what it means is that rather than being caught or being embedded in our tension, we're actually a little bit free of it. Step back. And in that freedom, there's a little bit of tranquility that holds it. We have much more choice. We can find more peace. Then we have a chance to find non-struggle. I had a wonderful conversation with someone recently who talked about his struggles with, he called it his ego. And he realized he really wanted to be free of this ego of his. It seemed to go everywhere with him. But then he learned that if he kind of stayed present and felt this self-centeredness that he had, or self-identification he was caught in, and really felt it and be present for it here in his body, and just be with it, that then there was space around it. And if there was and in the space, he found freedom. It didn't go away, but it was not such a big problem. He wasn't struggling with it. There was some freedom there. So there's Dharma tranquility, in part, means to learn how to be at ease with the difficulties of our life. Learn how not to tense up unnecessarily, or learn not to be bothered in an unhelpful way. Learn not to be struggling with things. Now, some people hearing this might rush to defend being tense or being in conflict and the value of it, because that's how we take care of things. And we do sometimes. But there are times when maybe we take care of things better if we're relaxed, if we're not tense. And maybe we can address things in a more powerful way and figure out what the right thing to do is if we're not in, create the blindness that comes with tension, the lack of, the insensitivity that comes with tension. We're much more sensitive beings. There's more creativity that can flow when there's no tension. So Dharma tranquility doesn't necessarily mean that we're tranquil. It means we're tranquil about being untranquil. That's a good beginning. Just getting a toehold into it. You don't have to be different, but create some space around it. And then the deeper the tranquility is, the more that can be a teacher. The deeper the relaxation and the calm is, the more we can learn about how we lose it. The more we kind of touch into deeper and deeper places of holding, of clinging, of places where we resist. And you can say we get more and more subtlety, but it turns out the subtlety, as we get closer and closer to the core of who we are, becomes a lot more and more important. It's like the root from which it all comes. So one of the really wonderful places, challenging places to discover some more tranquility about things, be more at ease with how things are, is learning the art of not taking things personally. And what does it mean to take things personally? I think it means to, in part many things, but it means to define ourselves by what's happened. That who our self-definition that we kind of live in is somehow been touched or created. I like the idea that it's created. It's constantly created. Don't take it personally as means that we don't allow the circumstances around us to define us. To not take it personally means to not make it about ourselves. And, so when is that appropriate and when isn't it? But there's lots of opportunities we have to realize where it's not so personal. It's not necessarily about us. Someone has a reaction, someone is maybe not feeling well, and so they snap at us, and so we take it personally until we find out that they just went through some huge tragedy in their life and they haven't had any sleep for 3 days and they have all these issues they're trying to solve and you say, oh. And then you kind of run, oh. And then compassion arises because you understand it. Oh, it's not about me. And then some part of us, part of me, then can relax. Oh, it's not about me. The this famous thought exercise that the Chinese philosopher Confucius wrote about. And someone's out in a lake with a boat, kind of pleasure boat, I guess, a little rowboat or something, and just kind of moving along. And another boat comes along and crashes into you. It's the person who gets up and is furious. Until they see that in the other boat, there's no person. Somehow it got unmoored or something, it's floating around. And And so then it no longer becomes personal. Or it becomes personal. Why wasn't I paying attention? But it's a wonderful thing. It's kind of a koan, kind of a wonderful question, wonderful discovery of how not to take things personally. And take things, be intimate. And be connected. And be responsive. But not make it, entangled with wanting people to like us, wanting to prove who we are to people, have a story about ourselves that we want to reinforce or apologize for, be someone for oneself. Then I think a lot of the ways that people struggle in their lives is by taking things personally or have this ego or self-identity that they're wrapped around that needs to be a certain way. And it's very deep. I mean, I can talk about it relatively lightly, but it's very deep, this whole thing of identity and taking things personally. It touches some of the core survival issues of human life and some of the lessons that we got when we were very young and about safety and belonging, inclusion. And so I don't want to make light of it and say it's easy, but this is why we have such a powerful practice like this, to really try to come in and go deep and really connect deeply and discover some very deep Dharma tranquility, Dharma peace or ease, deep, relaxing at the root of all things. So there it goes from delight to joy, to tranquility, and then happiness. And before I go on to happiness, there's another set of teachings the Buddha gives that's related to what we're teaching here, but they insert another quality into it, and that is confidence. And so there's delight, there's joy, and then tranquility and confidence are often kind of a pair. And then it goes to happiness. And so the idea of kind of relaxing or becoming tranquil, there's a way in which that I think the expectation in Dharma practice is that it also goes hand in hand with becoming more confident, which is a certain kind of strength that we have. And if we can learn to take things less and less personal, can that go hand in hand with becoming more confident? Is it possible to be confident without being egotistical? Is it possible to be confident without being caught up in a sense of self and self-identity issues? Absolutely. Confidence doesn't have to have anything to do with the stories we tell about ourselves. Confidence can be something of welling up of feeling of value, sense of purpose, sense of capacity and ability to find one's way and respond to the situation. It can be a powerful kind of sense of inner strength, that there's something here. It's possible to have very relaxed and be very strong at the same time. And with that confidence and relaxation, what I associate that with is feeling very deep contentment, a deep sense of being at home or grounded here. And that's a source of Dharma happiness, a happiness that does not come from winning the lottery, doesn't come from financial success, or doesn't come with having a perfect relationship or an imperfect relationship, but doesn't come from having wonderful recreational opportunities, doesn't come from all kinds of things, doesn't come from the world outside being a certain way, but rather it's something that wells up from the inside, like the confidence that wells up. Dharma happiness is somehow happiness which is not dependent on what's happening in the world, and also not necessarily dependent on what's happening within us. I've had happiness, strong states of happiness, an intense pain at the same time. And I would have, when I was young and before I started practicing, I would have thought that that was impossible, because the physical pain, that's just so captivating and so intense and so like absorbing and such a, you know, something you have to fix and get away from. Or I would despair and have a lot of self-pity, and all kinds of things would get kicked in with intense pain that I sometimes had. And then as I practiced with it, at some point I felt like, well, the pain is there, but I no longer identified with it. I no longer took it personally. I no longer struggled with it. And in not struggling with it, then there was distance from it, or a gap or space around it. And then, to my surprise, I discovered that I could be happy, simultaneous. And that kind of blew me away. It gave me a lot of encouragement and a lot of confidence in the practice. And then I've learned that certain kind of happiness or well-being or sense of rightness can be there even when I have emotions which conventionally are considered to be not so nice to have. Maybe people call negative emotions. But there also, this not taking it personally, not identifying, or not being in them, not living in them, is so important. And learning to recognize them, not be bothered by them, not be wedded to them, not be in reaction to them or in conflict with them, then it makes room for some other way of being. And there are these things that can exist simultaneous. So it's possible to feel anger or feel certain kinds of sadness, and at the same time feel within one a sense of well-being or rightness or settledness or certain kind of contentment or certain kind of happiness. So Dharma happiness, this Dharma thing is, you know, it's kind of like very, it has a whole different paradigm than what people are normally looking for. Because it doesn't mean that things have to go away. It means that we kind of shift our relationship to them and find our freedom with them. And so exactly how we find that freedom is part of the art. So whereas the Buddha talked about sukha, or talked about happiness, some people translate sukha as contentment. And what I like about the word contentment is that, I don't know what's in your vocabulary, but for me, contentment is an embodied state. When I feel content, it's really something I feel in my body more than I feel in my mind. And this wonderful thing of, that's why this tranquilizing the body, calming the body, so the body can feel, the body can express or show it's what's going on, makes like room in the body for contentment. So room in the body for this embodied happiness to be there when we're relaxed, calm. I also very much like the expression being at home. And I think many people have different relationships with the idea of home. But home for me is a place where, it's okay to be myself in my pajamas. You know, walk around in my underwear. Or, you know, I don't have to shave in public or something, you know. Just be myself and, you know, not have to worry about it and feel content and feel safe, feel happy, feel cozy. And so it's possible Dharma happiness is not found in your house. Dharma happiness, that sense of home, being at home in the universe, happens in you. And what's wonderful is then we become turtles, Dharma turtles, meaning you carry your home with you. wherever you go, you have access to your home because you have it here, and you're not looking for it outside or in the world around you. And that's a powerful thing, to go into the world and feel like you have it here. And then it's also easier to go into the world without conflict or struggle, because we're not looking for the world to provide something to make us okay. The sense of being okay is here. To be happy is here. And this is, I think, one of the really great gifts that this Dharma practice has done for me, is to show me that there's happiness that can live, that can be, maybe that's all I can say, just happiness that can be, that's not here for a reason. It's not because anything's happening out there, but it's not for a reason, it's for because of the conditions are such that I'm settled, I'm present, I'm not bothered, I'm not struggling. I'm not I, even. You know, it's just here. And it kind of wells up, or it's the harmonious operating of the system without, when there's no struggle or blockage in the system. That somehow the energies of our body can flow more freely when there's no tension or there's no, struggles. And there's something about that happiness seems to be built into the system. And when we're in harmony with ourselves. So much of our life is a lot easier if we don't struggle with it. Right now, sitting here, maybe because I'm wearing a long sleeve shirt, I'm starting to get hot. And I know the difference between just being hot and struggling with that. These days I have physical pain. No, it kind of goes with me much of the day. And I know the difference between having the pain and struggling and not struggling. And just there. I'm here, it's here, we're all here. You know, it's just part of it. I know what it's like to not have things go my way, the way I want it to go. And I know what it's like to struggle with that, or worry, or be anxious about it. And I know what it's like to be free with that, to not struggle with it, not be in contention with it. Figure out how best to respond and how to go forward from here, knowing this is not how I want it to be. So as you sit here on retreat, I'm sure there's things happening here which is not what you wanted. I'm sure that your mind has thoughts that you wish you didn't have, or feelings that you would wish you hadn't have, or that the food should have been different. The blankets should have been softer. The zabaton should have been green, not brown. There's no end, but all kinds of things that it's easy to. But how is it to have those and not struggle? To have those thoughts, have things be not the way you want. And this is a very, very important point. This, I think, is the point that I want to end this talk with. I say this often. So to go back, the subject for this talk is the Dharma. Dharma delight, Dharma joy, Dharma tranquility, Dharma happiness. So what's the Dharma in it? And the Dharma means to be free. But we can't really be free if we're only free when we're comfortable. That's not freedom. To be really free, we have to learn how to be free when we're uncomfortable as well. We have to be free even when things are not what we want them to be. And that's possible at any moment, in any circumstance. It's possible to find something of freedom, of space, of non-struggle. And it can make all the difference. So there's Dharma delight, Dharma joy, Dharma tranquility, Dharma happiness, and Dharma concentration. And in fact, maybe we can put the word Dharma in front of everything. There's what it is without it, and what it is with it. And there's you, and there's Dharma you. And my proposal is that Dharma you is more you than you. In the way I'm talking about it today. So maybe you'll love the Dharma you. Maybe you'll find your home, your peace, maybe how you really settle on yourself. Because for many people, the you is a struggle, is a step removed from really being here. And as Suzuki Roshi said, to paraphrase him, the Dharma is the Dharma when you are you. The Dharma you. Great, so thank you. And it might be nice to take a few seconds just to, if you're not already in your meditation posture or in a more seated way, and sit quietly and kind of, it's a way of moving into the transition of going back from the talk into the more retreat mode.